8:30 a.m. KSDP Radio. I'm Kels Hetherington, and this is Meet the People for March 17, 2010. My guest this morning is Charlie McCain. He is the author of a new book entitled An Honorable German. The book was published by Grand Central Publishing in May 2009. The book is on sale at Barnes & Nobles and at other major chains across the country and online at such retailers as Amazon.com. Additionally, a Kindle edition of Charlie McCain's book, An Honorable German, is also available. Well, welcome to the program, Charlie, and thank you for making time in your very busy schedule to visit with us on the radio this morning about your new book, An Honorable German. As I was reading it, it reminded me an awful lot of a book that I read a long time ago called The Caine Mutiny. So, good morning.
Good morning, Kels, and thank you so much for having me on. Alaska's a place I've always wanted to go, and hopefully I'll sell enough books in the next 30 minutes to make enough money to buy the plane ticket to go there. But I'm delighted to be here, and I'm pleased that you compared me to Herman Loke and the Caine Mutiny, which was one of the great books about seafaring in World War II that was written, and I'm very pleased about that.
Well, and I meant it, too. It did remind me of the Caine Mutiny when I read the An Honorable Gentleman. Maybe you could give our listeners a quick synopsis of the plot of your book.
The plot of the book is this, and I will tell everyone who's listening, if y'all don't mind if I refer to you as y'all, because I am from the South. Y'all, I was in the Tulane University library my fifth year in college. There was a reshelving cart next to me, which had some Time magazines from the year 1944. I picked one off the stack, flipped through it, came across an article about a group of German POWs who had been on a U-boat who escaped from a prison camp outside of Phoenix, Arizona. And I was astounded by that. And I read through the article, and I thought to myself, this would be a great novel, and how hard can that be, 30 years later? But the plot basically concerns a German naval officer who was aboard the German commerce raider Admiral Graf Spee, which is all, the entire novel is based on incidents which happened. And then he ends up on a German merchant raider, which were merchant ships that were armed, but they were disguised, and they'd creep up on British merchant ships and open fire. And then he commands a U-boat, and then, without ruining the story, he ends up in a prison camp in the United States. 375,000 German prisoners of war were held in the U.S., and I believe even some in Alaska.
Interesting. I didn't know that any prisoners of war had been held in Alaska, but I'm sure you know, because you're very well versed in the Second World War, and that comes through in your book. And what's interesting and very unique about An Honorable German is that, unlike most of the books about the Second World War, yours is from the perspective of a German naval officer. And if I'm correct, only four other books hold that distinction.
I didn't set out to be a person who was one of the few who had done that. I'm actually the only American author, it is thought, to write a World War II epic from the German point of view. Some people have written about little battles from the German point of view, but I wrote about the entire war. And, you know, I tell people, only I was stupid enough to do that because it took so many decades of research. But this is the fourth novel written with the German Navy as a backdrop. There are only three others written by Germans. And so I am very pleased with it. It was actually reviewed in the magazine of the Retired German Naval Officers Association last month. It's in German, of course. But I didn't set out to really have that distinction. I just set out to tell this story about these men, and it ended up sort of taking over part of my life, and telling it from the German point of view, that's just the only way I could tell tell the story. And so it ended up having that unique quality, which I would like to say I set out to do, but, you know, I didn't. I just did it because of the story.
Well, it came out very, very well, even if you did not entirely intend it to come out this way. Writing from the German perspective, were there any conflicts that you confronted as a writer, as a scholar, writing the book?
Well, what I always tell people when I speak is I always say, please remember there's a difference between the novel and the novelist. I hate the Nazis, although the main character is not a Nazi, and whatever we everything we did to Germany in World War II was fully justified, in my opinion, including the bombing of Germany. And when people have phoned me because the main character is in Berlin several times when it's bombed, and my friends have said, this is just so realistic, it's horrifying. I mean, how on earth would you think this? You were for the bombing of Berlin, and I said, I'm not the main character. The main character doesn't like being bombed. Mm. He's German. So you do walk a fine line between portraying what is very true, which is there were a number of honorable Germans, particularly in the German Navy, and there were plenty of Germans who were not honorable and were Nazis, but German and Nazi were not actually synonymous terms. German naval officers were not allowed to belong to the Nazi Party or any party. That does not mean that many did not support the Nazi Party. But many of them were old school officers, and in the last gasp of the definition of officer and a gentleman.
Hmm. Now, the book, of course, is a work of fiction, but some of what you write about is based in historical truth and the product of, quite literally, years of research on your part. How much of an honorable German is based in historical truth, and how much of it is the product of your imagination?
The entire, everything that happens with historical fiction, if you're an honorable historical fiction writer, and as I like to think that I am, you only write about things that did happen or reasonably could have happened. Almost all the incidents in the book, the major scenes, are based on actual events. And other scenes, such as, say, the bombing of Berlin, are just based on many books I read about Berlin being bombed. So it's not a specific incident, but Berlin was bombed many times. But the Grafschbay and things like that are all historical incidents that happened. So, you know, I mean, the plot of the book roughly is things that did happen or things that realistically could have happened, and that is, for an author of historical fiction, is very much the standard you need to stick to. At least I think so.
Your book, An Honorable German, has gotten a lot of traction. You're selling a lot of copies of the book. That's curious because the Second World War ended a long time ago now, and most of the people who served in it, unfortunately, have left us. I think we lose thousands and thousands of World War II veterans every day. I think 1,000 veterans leave us every day. Why do you suppose that a book about the Second World War has proven to be so popular so many years after the conclusion of the World War?
I think when I first started writing this book, Kells, in 1981, World War II was not a particularly popular subject, partly because the Vietnam War had divided people so bitterly in the 60s and 70s, but partially because it wasn't that unusual. In my generation, I mean, my father fought in the Pacific. I'm 54, so it wasn't strange to almost every adult male you met had been in the armed forces. But now, I think, because that's no longer true, because so many of those men have died, their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren are curious about what went on. And secondly, when you think about it, the Second World War is the largest event ever to take place in recorded human history. It is a cataclysmic event. We think about the meteors hitting the Earth and knocking it off its axis or whatever, and all the dinosaurs died. It was an event of almost that magnitude. I mean, it completely changed the world, and it very much dictates the world in which we live today. And we even, plenty of expressions that we use come from the Second World War. We just don't know that anymore. But I think people are curious as to this gigantic event in human history.
I think you're absolutely correct. The fascination of what has become over the years and unknown attracts people of another generation to read about, in books like An Honorable German, what took place in the Second World War. I found that reading the book myself. What have you heard from readers who have written you letters, who have gone to your website? And I don't know the web address of your site, but there is one out there, and people can blog about your book. What are the bloggers saying?
Well, the bloggers are saying, first, that my website, if I may be so bold as to say, is kind of easy to remember. It's charlesmccain.com. And I have a very active blog, and if you go to charlesmccain.com, it actually goes to my blog. And I confess that I have two very, very sharp bloginistas who keep it going, and I just do the writing, they do the rest. But I have gotten emails and letters and from really all over the country, from Canada, from South Africa, Australia, Europe, and the common thread people have is how fascinated they were by the book, how they couldn't put it down, which, of course, is designed. Quite frankly, a frat brother of mine in Mississippi said, there's no logical place to stop reading, and you don't find out what happens till the last page. And I said, listen, you dunce, do you think that was an accident? So what people tell me is they find the book fascinating. They had no idea of almost anything mentioned in the book. They never considered the war from the German perspective or any of the details. You know, the Germans drank Coca-Cola until the beginning of the war with the United States. The Germans actually loved Americans. They just didn't love us so much once Hitler declared war. Mm. People are not aware that Hitler declared war on the United States as opposed to the other way around. I would say 40% of my readers are women. It's been reviewed on so many blogs, I can barely keep up with it. And many of the reviews have been so good, I got to tell you, I myself would not have written them, and I'm not a shrinking violet. So people have been fascinated with the intimacy of the book, not in terms of, you know, people having sex, although the main characters of Max and his fiance obviously occasionally do that when they're together. But in terms of the anguish and the mental thoughts and stuff of the people on the German side, what that is like to be in a country where you're losing a war, and it becomes more and more obvious that is happening. And what do you do? I mean, you're caught up in a situation beyond your control. Every place you go, nothing works. Everything's been bombed to pieces. And people seem to connect with that in the sense they connect with the characters, who are very real people.
Hmm. What was your purpose in writing a book? Did you want to entertain people? Did you want to inform people? What was the mission?
Well, that just came up actually a week ago with a friend of mine who had written a nonfiction scholarly book on U.S. submarines in the Pacific in World War II. And he had asked me something about my book, and I emailed him and I said, the difference between us is you are trying to inform people, and I am entertaining people, and I am using the history as the backdrop of the stage. So if you think of the book as sort of a play or a musical or whatever, you know, there's always a backdrop to the stage. But the characters are always on the center of the stage, and they're never overwhelmed by the background. you can make the background to add enrichment to the characters in the center, on the center of the stage, then the book has a sense of truthfulness and a richness to it. And that's what I was trying very much to do. But definitely anybody who writes fiction is meant to entertain you. It's meant to, the thing that pleases me the most is people say they picked it up, they couldn't put it down, they read it over a weekend, it captured their attention, which means it took them away from their worries for, you know, a period of time, and that's what entertainment is supposed to do.
Now, you're also working on another book. Is it also going to be about the Second World War?
Yes, and it's going to be about a German naval officer in the Second World War, and I've almost finished the proposal. Fortunately, if you've published one novel, I have a literary agent, and she can shop the second novel just based on a proposal, because people know you can actually write. And what happened, Kels, is I acquired this huge body of knowledge about the German Navy. It was sort of by happenstance, including I met people in the German Navy, and I have a friend of mine who recently retired from the German Navy. I met on the internet. I met him in New York about a year ago when he was there. He was tremendously helpful in getting all these little tiny details about the German Navy correct. And so, this is sort of marketing. I've blocked everybody out of the marketplace. It's the barrier to entry to write about the German Navy in an accurate way. I set standard, so anybody who does it is going to be compared to me. And it took me so many years to learn it that I can keep everybody out of my market space. So I plan to continue that. And it also fascinates me, and also from this point of view, Kels, I grew up in a town, Orangeburg, South Carolina, and South Carolina obviously played a major role in the Civil War. And my hometown was burned by Union troops, and I hope none of your ancestors were involved in that, Kels. And
we'll take that offline sometime.
South Carolina. What people told me about the Civil War was from their perspective, and that is the perspective of people who had lost the Civil War, who were living in a place where, the Union troops, there had been a fighting, they had burned down the town. And so their version of the Civil War was totally different from the version I learned in college, the academic version, which is the one that's correct. But I even found in searching things in the library when I was a student, telegrams from the Confederate commanders and Union commanders around my little town of Orangeburg. In fact, there's one from the Confederate commander saying he's at the Shillings Ford in the river, and he's crossing that, and he's falling back. Confederates did a lot of falling back. And when I was a kid, they built a bridge at the Shillings Ford called the Shillings Bridge, and we used to jump off of it into the river. And you're kind of, it's very, very personal. So you get a sense of the Southerners tell themselves a different story about the Civil War, and Germans tell themselves a different story about the Second World War, or certainly they did at the time.
And you're absolutely right. It's often a politically driven dichotomy of history, and it's happening more and more and more. I heard a story just recently about a school district in Texas that is changing the way it teaches students about Thomas Jefferson. With that all in mind, is there a way in which the history of the Second World War is morphing because of political pressures being applied?
I don't think the history of the Second World War, to a degree, the groups that have been marginalized in our country, African Americans, for instance, women, their stories, gay people, their stories are being told, and that hasn't happened heretofore. But I don't think you're finding any distortion of World War II. The distortion of World War II history comes from the fact that much of what is history, which has been written, was written by people who either participated or knew people who participated, knew them well, and they have a natural bias when they write. And a key example of this is the Enigma machine, the ultra intelligence. The Allies at the British first, and then later the Americans with them, associated with them, cracked the German code, their top secret code that everybody, every organization in Germany used, and the armed forces, the railway, etc. And the Germans believed this could not be compromised, it could not be cracked. And it was cracked in the beginning of the war by actually a gay British mathematician named Alan Turing, who's the father of the computer age, who invented the computer to crack the code. 85%, we read 85% of secret German radio traffic. What is happening now is that historians are going back and realizing that many battles won by American and British commanders were won because they had all the information about the Germans, when the Germans were going to attack, for instance, how many troops they had, who was in command. So this, as you might imagine, was very useful. And so reputations are being reassessed in the light of that. But that's typical in history.
If you're just joining us here on 8:30 a.m. KSDP, it's Meet the People. I'm Kels Hetherington. I'm talking with Charles McCain. He is the author of a new book entitled An Honorable German. You can find it on Amazon.com. Charlie, how much of Charlie McCain comes through in the book An Honorable German?
Well, unquestionably, Kels, no matter what you do, a part of the author is in every character, and how could it not be? And I don't notice it as much, but friends of mine have read it. When they read it, they've said, well, we come to certain passages and we can just hear Charlie McCain, which is sort of amusing, but certainly, the main character has elements based on my personality, because I'm the person I know the best. But, of course, I'm not the main character. So since I didn't command a U-boat and I'm not German and I was born way after the Second World War in the United States, but unquestionably people, what I noticed, and somebody told me this, I got to tell you, I feel kind of stupid. Well, I feel stupid a lot of time, but somebody told me who knew a lot about literature, like you do, Kels.
No, I have very
Charlie,
little. Yeah, I know very little
said,
about
Charlie, but a friend said, Charlie, you don't find the symbolism in your own book. Other people find it. It's your unconscious that goes into it. And I was like, oh, I didn't know that. And so people write me or email me and tell me things they found in the book that they interpreted in a certain way, and I'm sort of flabbergasted. And I'll give you one example, which is funny. I will just tell you that the main character, the woman who's the fiance of the main character, and obviously she plays a major role. Her name is Marith, M-A-R-E-T-H, and. M-A-R-E-T-H, yes. And a friend of mine emailed me and said that he had a German friend, a German couple were friends, and they spent the entire weekend debating where this name of Marith came from in Germany, because it was very unique. And they decided it came from West Mecklenburg province that existed before World War II. I didn't even know where it was. And my friend said, is that true? And I emailed him back, and I said, I hate to tell you this, but when I was writing the rough draft in World War, when the Germans attacked France, the French fell back onto a line of trenches and defense works called the Marith Line. And I thought, that sounds like a good name for the girl in the book.
That's very interesting.
So, people find things that to me are, and that's an old job was to name people after cities or some geographical thing that's named for someone. But, you know, that's how those things, some things happen. And then people spend all kinds of time wondering, you know, the deep reason. And there's no reason. I mean, literally, I was writing and I just noticed a book, a Marath line. Oh, that sounds good.
It would be interesting to talk to, like, one of your old girlfriends and see if they have anything to say about the relationship that this fellow, who's a naval officer on the German boat, has the fiancé, his fiancé is Marath.
Well,
I mean, they might say, oh, yeah.
I don't know what they would say about that, but I would say that, you know, first, because I'm gay, so I don't have a lot of ex-girlfriends, but any intimate personal relationship that people have is going to be based on both the author's perception and the author's experience in terms of what's realistic. And I tried to create the most realistic characters and relationships that were possible. And part of that is just observing other people. And so the main characters, the two main characters, Max and his fiancée, Marath, you know, they yell at each other. They get mad. They get in arguments. I mean, they misunderstand each other. And they, you know, her father doesn't like him. But these are all things that happen to people, people that I know, and so, or even me. So if you pay attention as a novelist, you have to be a keen student of human nature. And I admit to being a shameless eavesdropper as well when I'm in a coffee shop. I write down, sometimes not the entire conversation, but people will say certain lines, and I'll go, wow, that's good, and I'll write it down, or they'll be talking about something in their relationship, and I'll go, and I'll write that down, and I'll go, I'll use that in the next, you know, another novel, so.
Wow, you got to be careful what you say
in
coffee
shops. You try to draw things from everywhere.
Now, I wanted to ask you, you talk about relationships and how to write about relationships and writing things down in coffee shops that are being discussed between couples, I guess. The relationship between Max and his fiancée is extremely interesting because there is a triangular aspect to this relationship. Max's good friend is also a good friend of this woman, Marath, and he is viewed more favorably by Marath's family. Am I correct in that? And I guess my question
That's
to
right.
you is, if this other guy is so close and he's a friend of Marath, how come he isn't able to win her affection more successfully than Max is?
Well, it's the classic sort of opposites attract. And I would tell people, I would say, you know, Marath is like the wealthy young woman on the Upper East Side of New York who meets a good, solid guy from Alaska with, you know, solid values, works hard, worked his way up from a, you know, respectable family, and she's drawn to that because it's very different than her own background. And so that really is part of the attraction between them, besides the physical attraction. She thinks the other guy, Dieter, who is Max's best friend, is a jerk. So she thinks he's very irresponsible. Dieter, I will tell you, is based loosely on one of my best friends who I've known since he was 17. And actually, people who don't know me but know him have read the book and said, oh, I guess you're Dieter then. Dieter is actually based on a real person who was quite a Lothario for much of his life, although he is now happily married with four beautiful children. But there's actually conversation between Max and Dieter, which is basically conversations I have with my friend.
Well, I guess where my concerns was for Max was that Dieter might really not be a true friend, and that it was likely a good thing that Dieter was on the ship with Max. Is there any threat that Dieter may pose to Max in his relationship with Marath if they were not in the same jurisdiction, you know, on the same boat together?
Yeah. No, there isn't. And the reason is, it's not that Marath liked Dieter better. It's that her parents liked him better because Dieter himself is an aristocrat, whereas Max is not. Marith is herself an aristocrat. But she, Marith is actually loosely based also on someone that I know, a longtime woman friend I've known since college, who's a very strong-willed person. I mean, very strong-willed. And if she's listening, she'll know who I'm talking about. And so, I mean, sort of a will of iron like Marith has. So Marith is very much in love with Max, and so nothing would have distracted her from that, and Dieter certainly would not have. She thought he, you know, he conducts himself in such a wild manner that would never be something she was attracted to. Max is very stable, and that's something that she very, very much wants. So I never thought that there would be any kind of problem. And in fact, Max often took Dieter with him when he was originally dating Marith, because Dieter was very entertaining but posed no threat because Marith was not attracted to him.
Yeah, and I guess so Max is correct in his analysis that Dieter is not a threat. Well, I wondered about that. I thought it might be a good idea for Max to distance himself now from this fellow Dieter who might be a threat at some point in the future. The other relationship that is extremely interesting is the relationship between the captain of the German ship that Max is serving on. He often disagrees with the captain, and Max almost misses some very important aspects of the developing story. For example, when they are leaving South America after a fight with the British Navy, the captain correctly concludes that they are probably steaming directly into a flotilla of British Navy vessels, and they should turn back and get their own vessel returned before they try to go all the way back to Europe. Why is it that Max misses some of the things that one in the naval profession might conclude or should conclude if they want to progress in their career? Is he stupid, or is he just young and naive?
Well, Max is young and aggressive, and Captain Langsdorff, who was the actual captain of the Grafsch Bay, and is depicted very much as a true gentleman, which he was, and that actually comes from his enemies who wrote about him. The British merchant captains that he captured wrote about him extensively, and he would apologize for sinking their ships and stuff like that. And he actually seized 11 British merchant ships and never killed anybody. Mm-hmm. But the issue becomes after this battle in the book, which is based on the Battle of the Rio Plata, the River Plate, that a Royal Navy ship, and you see this throughout World War II, in the British Royal Navy, which the Germans were quite jealous of, it would not have mattered if you were in a rowboat. If there were an enemy ship in sight and you still could move, you stayed, you didn't break off an engagement. The Germans broke off the engagement in the Battle of the Rio Plata, and Max disagrees with that because, not that he's naive, but because he very much understands that they need to establish the same sort of tradition as the Royal Navy, and that once again, as happened in World War One, the Royal Navy has chased the Germans back into port. The Battle of Jutland, the biggest battleship clash in history, which occurred in 1916, the German battle fleet went back to Germany and, you know, got bottled up by the British. And it was, you know, considered a national disgrace in Germany. And so Max is very annoyed that the captain won't take the example of the Royal Navy and just go at the British, because that's how the Royal Navy operated and was expected to operate. An example would be a British destroyer, HMS Glowworm, which is kind of a bizarre name, was covering some troop transports that were withdrawing British troops from Norway after Norway surrendered to the Germans. And a German cruiser, heavy cruiser, five times bigger than the destroyer, happened onto the scene. And the destroyer was the only, you know, war vessel there, and they just turned and went hell for leather at the German cruiser. And, I mean, to the point where they rammed it and cut a huge hole in the side of it. And, of course, their ship was already aflame. But they saved the convoy, although almost everybody on the British ship, warship, the crew and the officers were killed. Even though the Germans then stopped their ship and picked up the British sailors who had survived. But that was the tradition of the Royal Navy. That is their tradition throughout their history. And that was has not been the tradition of the German Navy. The German Navy did not have the history of the British Navy. And the American Navy very much has the same tradition as the Royal Navy. You see the enemy, and you go at them. The Germans did not have that tradition. Their Navy was fairly new, and Max knows this. And he's very upset at this lack of aggression on the part of the captain. And I'd say most historians who read about the battle, Langsdorff made the correct decision to break off the battle and go into the harbor. But I think that the various historians that have written about it have come to the conclusion, which I believe very much, was that if it were a British ship, they never would have done that. They would have just fought till they sank.
Now, if you're just joining us on the radio, we got a few more minutes with our guest, Charlie McCain. He is the author of a book entitled An Honorable German. The book is not just a dry history about the Second World War and the German Navy. Rather, it is an enticing book about human nature and strategy and political conflicts on a global span. What I wanted to ask you about is the way in which prisoners taken at sea are treated. The captain of the German vessel that Max is serving on in the book treats the prisoners in a very strange way. He treats them almost as if they are guests aboard his vessel, not political, not prisoners taken in a time of war. Why does he treat them with such generosity?
Well, he's treating the prisoners on the Graf Spee very much according to the letter of the Geneva Convention. And there are actually two of them at that time. The Geneva Conventions, which very much concern treatment of the enemy sick and enemy prisoners of war. And they are to be treated as exactly as you treat your own men. And one of the things the United States, by the way, can be extremely proud of is during the Second World War, when we held all these German POWs, 375,000, we treated them to the letter of the Geneva Convention, and it went a long way towards cementing our post-war relationship with Germany. The Germans did not treat our prisoners nearly as well, but they didn't, you know, they didn't execute them except on several occasions, but they didn't have enough food. It was very, very, you know, it's not a comparison, but we really treated the Germans well, and old-line naval officers, especially on both sides, felt an obligation to treat men well that they captured and to observe their rank as well. So, as I said, when HMS Glowworm rammed the German cruiser Hipper and the HMS Glowworm sank, the Glowworm had done significant damage to the Hipper, but the Hipper stopped for 30 minutes and picked up the 50 or 60 surviving British sailors. And that was something you would expect. I mean, the ancient law of the sea is very powerful, and to save life at sea is something that continues even in wartime, even if you're not supposed to do it.
Yeah. Well, I highly recommend your book, An Honorable German. It is a story of human nature and of political intrigue and of what it was like to be on a naval vessel. Very exciting book, a real page-turner, and I recommend it. It is a lot like The Caine Mutiny, which is an American classic. I've also read that book. And so I highly recommend the book, and I hope it continues to be the success that it has been. Well, Charlie, thanks for coming on the radio this morning and making time available to me to discuss your most recent book on the radio.
Thank you, Kels, and I'll look forward to coming to Sandpoint and making a speech about it.
All right, sounds good. There you go. Thanks. That was Charlie McCain. He is the author of a recent book entitled An Honorable German. The book is available at Barnes & Noble's and at major bookstore chains across the country, as well as online at places like Amazon.com, where it is also available as a Kindle edition. And so I highly recommend the book. I have read most of it and intend to read it to the end. We'll now go back to some music, and then we'll go to NPR News at the top of the hour. You're listening to 8:30 a.m. KSDP. That's Meet the People.